This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, the Supreme Court heard arguments about detainees held at Guantanamo Bay and whether they have the right to challenge their imprisonment in federal court. Some 300 men are being held at the U.S. base in Cuba. All of them are foreigners. Most of them were arrested in Pakistan or Afghanistan, and many have been held for as long as 6 years. Lawyers for the detainees charge they face indefinite detention with no meaningful way to challenge their status as enemy combatants. The Bush administration contends that there are tribunals for the detainees and that foreigners held outside U.S. territory have no constitutional right to petition civilian courts. Some of the other issues include whether the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is effectively U.S. territory, and whether Congress was right when it passed a law last year that specifically declares that the courts have no authority to hear detainee cases. We'll go through today's arguments in a moment, and we'll hear from advocates on both sides. We also want to hear from you. In a war like no other, what are the rights of detainees, who include some of the men responsible for the attacks on 9/11? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later, actor Avery Brooks joins us. He currently stars as a great conqueror in Christopher Marlowe's play Tamburlaine. But first, detainees' rights, and we begin with our friend David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program again, David.
Hi, Neil.
And for those listeners who think they've entered a time warp, this is not the first time the courts have heard arguments about detainees in Guantanamo.
That's certainly right. I feel like we've been writing about it for 5 or 6 years. The court in 2004 basically said, yes, habeas corpus does apply. These people can go into federal court. There was some further hearings. The Bush administration went back to Congress, and Congress said, no, the habeas corpus law doesn't apply to these people held at Guantanamo and enemy combatants. All their cases got thrown out of court. They appealed, and the Supreme Court's agreed to hear the case again and sort of rule, does the Constitution give a person who's held for a long time by U.S. authorities a right to challenge their detention in the federal court? So basically, we're back where we were 3 years ago.
And that case is the Rasool case, which we'll hear several references to. And indeed, listening to some of the arguments, it's now become sort of regular for the Supreme Court to issue tape recordings, audio tape recordings of the arguments on controversial cases, and much more frequently than they used to in the old days. But as you listen to some of these arguments, this was some of the most obscure and detailed references that very difficult for a layman to follow.
Very difficult for someone who follows the court to follow. Because, you know, everybody agrees that there's a right to habeas corpus, but there's not a lot of law and not a lot of agreement on how far it extends. Everyone agrees, including Justice Scalia, that if you are picked up in the United States and you're a citizen, the government can't lock you away. You have a right to go to the habeas corpus. But what about overseas? What if the United States picks up somebody in Iraq or Afghanistan, or in this case, Guantanamo? How far does that right go? And so they spent a lot of time sort of arguing, what was the original understanding of habeas corpus? And Scalia says it's citizens. And Seth Waxman, arguing for the detainees, was saying basically in England, a subject is a very broad definition. You could be a subject of the king even if you were nowhere near England. So you should interpret it broadly that if U.S. authority extends there, habeas corpus extends there. And that's why they were mired in the mid-1700s.
So they're not just arguing about what the founders intended in American law, but English common law, which was, of course, the basis of our courts.
That's exactly right, because habeas corpus was incorporated into U.S. law, and the question is, what was meant when habeas corpus was put into the U.S. Constitution?
Well, let's listen to some of the arguments that we heard in court today. In his opening statement, detainee attorney Seth Waxman, he was Solicitor General, of course, in the Clinton administration, he argued the importance of habeas corpus for his clients.
The petitioners in these cases have three things in common. First, all have been confined at Guantanamo for almost 6 years, yet not one has ever had meaningful notice of the factual grounds of detention or a fair opportunity to dispute those grounds before a neutral decision maker. Two, under the decision below, they have no prospect of getting that opportunity. And three, each maintains, as this court explained in Rasool, that he is, quote, innocent of all wrongdoing. Now, the government contends that these men are detainable, and the facts of these 37 cases differ, and it may well be that an adjudicatory process that preserves the core features of common law habeas would reveal, perhaps, that some of these petitioners are lawfully detainable. But limited DTA review of the structurally flawed CSRT process cannot provide any reliable examination of the executive's asserted basis for detaining these petitioners, let alone an adequate substitute for traditional habeas review.
And there's a couple of acronyms we have to uncoil there. DTA, that's the Detainee Treatment Act?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
That's the law Congress passed to sort of set the rules here.
And then the CSRTs.
Combatant Status Review Tribunal.
And those are the military courts set up to hear the cases of the detainees?
Yes. You remember the Rasool decision you referred to. After that, the Bush administration was told, give these people a hearing. So they had a hearing with three military officers. And it's not really a hearing where you get to challenge the evidence, because they just come in and say, we have a memo saying that you were picked up with an AK-47. That's the end of the matter.
And this,
And Seth Waxman is saying, that's inadequate. We never get a chance to really show that my client was a teacher. He wasn't a fighter.
And this is supposed to be the equivalent of the hearing the military is supposed to have when they pick up people in the field.
Yes, that's right. It was supposed to be the substitute for that. And Seth Waxman is just saying, it's not nearly adequate. It's a sham. And we can't go to court and sort of ask for a review of the CSRT because we never got a chance to present our own case in the first place.
And let's hear the government's case. This is the current Solicitor General, Paul Clement, giving a summary of the government's case and explaining what the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005 provides for detainees.
Since this court's decision in Rasool, petitioner's status has been reviewed by a tribunal modeled on Army Regulation 190-8, and Congress has passed two statutes addressing petitioner's rights. Petitioners now have access to the Article III courts and have a right to judicial review in the D.C. Circuit. That review encompasses preponderance claims, claims that the military did not follow their own regulations, and statutory and constitutional claims.
General Clement, when you say it was modeled after 190.8, is it identical to 190.8?
Justice Stevens, it's virtually identical. If you look at pages 50 and 51 of our brief, you'll see kind of a side-by-side comparison. And the deviations are ones that we would submit enhance the rights of the detainees in this particular circumstance. So they are given a right to a personal representative, which is not something that Army Regulation 190-8 provides. They're specifically provided for the ability to submit evidence.
How is that personal representative chosen?
The personal representative is assigned to the individual by the military.
That personal representative also under an obligation to report back to the military anything that might be unfavorable to the person he is supposedly representing?
Well, I don't know about unfavorable, but I think if there's material intelligence information, he is to provide that information.
So he's not in the position of counsel as we understand the term.
No, we're not trying to make the point that the personal representative is a counsel. We're just saying it's something that's provided above and beyond 190-8 in terms of the procedure. And there are other particulars as well, like there is the notice of the charges in the unclassified summaries that are provided. Now, there's the complaint on the other side that the unclassified summaries aren't particular enough, but it's worth noting that that's something that's provided here that's not specified by
190-8. Under 190.8, does a defendant have a right to counsel?
No, they do not, not under the basic regulations of that.
And again, that Solicitor General Paul Clement in an interchange with a couple of the justices there on the question of, effectively, do they have rights to counsel? And David Savage, as you listen to these arguments, sometimes you can come away with some perception as to which way the court is going. And I've heard this case described as a case directed at one justice in particular.
Yes, this is almost surely a 4-4-1 case going in, that there's four on the conservative side: Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. Four on the liberal side, you heard some of them, John Stevens, David Souter, Ruth Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer, because they've sort of talked about this before. And Anthony Kennedy's right in the middle. He's sort of a swing vote on all the closely divided cases. And he seemed, as the argument went on, he didn't say a lot, But my sense is that he would like to have these be military hearings, not hearings before a federal judge, but better military hearings, hearings with real rights. And he seemed to be searching for a middle ground that would say, yes, you can do this through the military system, but you've got to have a real and a fair hearing. And my impression is that that he will try to write an opinion that sort of goes in that direction. It says, yes, you can have military hearings, but there's got to be the detainees have to have a lot more rights than they have under this procedure.
But to have them go into courts martial would suggest that they would be then military prisoners or prisoners of war. The government would object to that.
Well, the government, I think, is objects to suppose you have a situation where they need more evidence from somebody. You say, I was a teacher in Afghanistan. I wasn't a fighter. And I need some evidence. I need some affidavits or whatever. The government doesn't want to get involved in providing any evidence like that. They don't want to have a lawyer. They don't want to have real thorough procedures to be fought out. And I think Kennedy wants something that looks fairer, much fairer than what we've got right now.
And as you listen to the argument, we just have a few seconds before we go to the break, but any indication as to which way that this is going to lean?
Well, just as a guess, I think there'd be a 5-4 vote to say reverse the D.C. court, say, yes, these people get some procedures, much more than what they have now, but we're not going to send it into regular, we're not going to give everybody a hearing before a federal judge in Washington.
David Savage, stay with us, if you will. We're talking about arguments today at the Supreme Court over the rights of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Up next, a member of the legal team working on behalf of the detainees and a former government lawyer who supports the administration. And we want to hear from you on this. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. We're talking about today's case before the Supreme Court, an argument over the rights of detainees at Guantanamo Bay to have their day in U.S. courts. Twice before, in 2004 and 2006, the court ruled against the Bush administration's detention policies. A decision is expected in this case in mid-2008. David Savage is with us. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. If you'd like to join us, what are the rights of detainees in this war like no other? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Gitanjali Gutierrez. She's a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and part of the legal team that argued on behalf of the detainee rights before the Supreme Court today. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Pleasure to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And let me also introduce David Rifkin, a legal and policy advisor for the first Bush and Reagan administrations, currently a partner with the law firm Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C., also joining us here in Studio 3A. And thanks very much for your time
as well. Good to be with you.
And very broadly, can you tell us, first of you, Ms. Gutierrez, what is this case really about?
In 2004, when the Supreme Court first made a ruling on the rights of the detainees, it was really about the rights of these men in Guantanamo. But now, as you said, we're looking at a decision coming out in 2008, and it's really about the relationship between the courts and the executive and Congress thrown into the middle of it. And the fundamental question is, what power does the executive have to hold individuals in Guantanamo or in a place that's under the president's exclusive control, and whether the president has to justify the detention in a federal court? And a lot of the discussion today was in reference and referenced the decisions of the political branches and whether or not those were subject to judicial review.
Mm-hmm. And from your point of view, David Rifkin, what do you see this case as fundamentally being about?
Ironically enough, we agree. This case is not fundamentally about the rights of detainees. This case is fundamentally about the key issue. If Constitution does apply, what it means is that the political decisions by the two political branches, speaking on behalf of American people, are greatly constrained by the constitutional imperatives as construed by the court. If, on the other hand, there are no constitutional imperatives that shape the conduct, and by the way, Neil, it is far more than the rights of detainees. Mm-hmm. We really are talking about the entire panoply of actions by United States government overseas operating on foreigners, not U.S. citizens. Constitution doesn't apply, then basically two political branches, and we can argue about how much Congress has to say versus how much the executive, but the two political branches, whatever they say goes. What we are talking about is an unprecedented proposition that runs squarely in the face of our constitutional history, constitutional language, and the court's own decisions as recently as this administration, which stands for the proposition that Constitution does not govern the conduct of U.S. government against foreigners overseas. And again, that would be things like surveillance, like seizure of person and property, use of deadly force. If Constitution applies in one full swoop, the Supreme Court becomes, and federal courts, the ultimate arbiters of American foreign policy, because let's face it, the last 100 years have witnessed enormous constraints being put on the ability of political branches to operate domestically. Mm-hmm. If the same setup applies overseas, everything would change. That is what's most important about this case.
But couldn't you narrow that? As I think it was Justice Kennedy who said in a previous ruling in this series of cases, Guantanamo Bay is, to all practical effects, American soil.
It is very difficult, Neil, to do that for a couple of reasons, because in a leading case involving Stout-Eisentrager, you had people held, German nationals held in occupied Germany. And let me tell you, we had more rights in occupied Germany than we have in Guantanamo today. Because in occupied Germany, there was no other government, local, provincial, or national. We held the totality of power. Today, I would submit to you that in places like Iraq or places like Bagram Air Force Base. And remember, it's interesting because both Justices Alito and Chief Justice Roberts kept asking questions. Well, who gets to decide if it's not formal sovereignty? Because everybody agrees we're not formally sovereign in Guantanamo. Who gets to decide how much control is enough? And there was a very interesting observation by Chief Justice Roberts that if a court decides that we have more control than the political branches believe, wouldn't it have diplomatic problems? And wouldn't it even, as Justice Alito pointed out, couldn't it lead to war?
Mm-hmm. Gitanjali Gutierrez, again, if the court narrowly says, well, look, Guantanamo Bay is basically American soil, but then that opens the question about there are 305 men being held at Guantanamo Bay, but there are others, the detainees at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, others being held in Iraq, these so-called ghost detainees. We don't know how many of them there are or where they are.
I guess I disagree with a couple of points that David made. Guantanamo is extraordinarily unique, and it was chosen as a place to hold Guantanamo detainees very deliberately by the executive. It's the only base that we have right now that's under exclusive U.S. jurisdiction and control. No other government's law applies.
Overseas base.
Overseas base. No other government's laws apply. No other U.S. law applies except for what the president says. Our base that was involved in Germany in the Johnson v. Eisentrager case that's David referenced was actually under joint control by a number of allies. Those prisoners were not under exclusive U.S. jurisdiction and control. And the decision, the circumstances of the case before the court right now really just involve Guantanamo. But the legal principle that they're addressing is one that falls squarely within habeas jurisdiction and within habeas cases going back to the Magna Carta. Habeas is not a reference to every constitutional right. Habeas is a historical legal mechanism that allows someone who's been plucked up by the king and thrown into prison with no trial and no hearing and no opportunity to contest their innocence and is left there really potentially for the rest of their lives. Habeas allows that individual to go into an independent court and ask for some kind of legal process. That is not applying every constitutional right all over the world. And certainly the justices made a number of references today about the narrow, narrow right that they were considering and a number of other legal doctrines that would allow them to not interfere with foreign relations or diplomatic issues that might come in a case in the future. But certainly that's not the case before them today.
All right. Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255 or email talk@npr.org. We'll start with Ted, and Ted's with us from Novato in California.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
This is a very important discussion, but, you know, I think there's a couple of points being lost on most of us out here who live outside of the Beltway. First of all, why are so many people actively in our country, American-born citizens, lobbying for the rights of people who in a minute would slit their throats on an airplane or would think nothing of driving airplanes into buildings or whatnot? Secondly, you know, people are losing their houses, gasoline's going up, the cost of living. And it's so absurd. Yes, as a country And as a republic, we certainly want to address this in a fair way. But let's not forget that these people, first of all, are not U.S. citizens. So the analogy about the kingdom and the king, you know, offering protections to all of his subjects implies sort of a certain legitimacy to their residency and a legality that is just not present in this case. Secondly, if the treatment there is so bad, how come, you know, Michael Moore went down there with a camera crew and showed in the movie Sicko that these prisoners have better health care than the average American who's struggling to pay his or her health care costs? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's sort of a beltway discussion here that plays well at the Georgetown cocktail party on K Street, but it's not going to play well in Main Street. So I just wanted to address that.
Gitanjali Gutierrez, I think that's to you.
Certainly. I'd have to say first that I am a outside the Beltway kind of individual and share some of your concerns that this debate has been distorted in many ways. Those of us at the Center for Constitutional Rights that have been litigating these cases are really defending the Constitution as much as we're defending the rights of the individual who are in prison. And since September 11th, we've seen a number of practices by the executive that violate the Constitution, and it hasn't been just the men in Guantanamo who've been detained as enemy combatants. There have also been several U.S. citizens who were picked up in the United States and held in military detention without access to their lawyer, without any opportunity to go into federal court, and held as enemy combatants. So in many ways, the challenges that we bring are about our checks and balances and separation of powers. And I would also very much agree with you that the debate around how we're going to fight the war on terrorism is in many ways a rhetorical device that detracts from what really are the problems in our country right now. We have many tools in our criminal justice system to investigate, prosecute, convict people who commit acts of terrorism. Those individuals are sitting in federal prison today. And the idea that we have Guantanamo, the money and the resources that are being put into keeping 340-something men in prison, the vast majority of whom never fought against the United States or engaged in hostilities against the United States, I think has been an incredible waste of resources that could be much better spent.
Do you realize the intelligence that's come out of Guantanamo? Do you realize that lives have been saved because of some of the interrogation techniques? And I'm sorry, but I don't think, you know, lowering the temperature in a room or depriving somebody of sleep or even, I dare use the word, the W word, waterboarding is a gross violation of someone's intrinsic human rights. Those are things that are all done to military personnel, particularly at the officer level, on a regular basis. And I say the people that are advocating for these criminals in Guantanamo, somebody in Iraq right now is carrying their pack. They ride for free.
I'd have to say that I go to Guantanamo frequently to meet with the men there, and we'll be going again at the end of this week. And according to the military's own records on the men who've been held there, 92% of them are not classified as al-Qaeda fighters. And I question the facts behind the administration's assertions that Guantanamo has led to a great deal of intelligence value. And from a national security perspective, I think that the bridges we've burned with allies in the Middle East and Arab countries who could potentially help our intelligence officers on the ground infiltrate terrorist organizations has come at too high a cost.
Don't you think?
Ted, I wanted to give somebody else a chance here. So, but thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. Go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, nothing illustrates, and I agree with a caller in many respects, but nothing illustrates more the profound gap between the critics and myself and other people who are basically with administration in this, and her points that the criminal justice system, which is basically a full-fledged criminal justice trial, is a sufficient remedy. It is utterly insufficient. It is utterly inappropriate for most wartime exigencies. The vast number of individuals we hold, not only in Guantanamo, and they're not innocent shepherds, most of them al-Qaeda fighters, a large number of people have been released, gone back to fighting. We're holding hundreds of al-Qaeda and Taliban personnel in Afghanistan and Iraq. And these people cannot be released. They cannot be prosecuted successfully, criminal justice system. But it's never enough. We began several years ago with people asking for a little more due process in the military justice system. And here we are. We've come full circle. And basic idea is let's treat them as Zakarias Mousavi. Let's put them for federal district court. The entire criminal justice paradigm is not suited for this. Most of them would be let go if that's what was done.
Let's get Ray on the line. Ray with us from San Francisco.
From another quarter, perhaps, we might argue that when we enter a courtroom to try to find out what happened in the case of a crime that was alleged, let's think of it as a local crime, not necessarily outside of the United States or its territories, perhaps could be committed by a U.S. citizen or a non-citizen. Let's say there was a a person intoxicated behind the wheel of an automobile driving around in the neighborhood threatening children at the school crossing. And there was an arrest, and the allegation is that this person was behaving in a way that endangered the people in the neighborhood. What we want when we enter the courtroom, this is the case that we want to put forward here, we would argue to establish who is the responsible party for this alleged violation. And in order to do that, we would present the evidence. To do that with lights out and to not apply scientific methods.
We're hearing your analogy, but is there a question here?
Yeah, the question is, how can we find out what an alleged assailant or violator has done if we do not apply the instruments of law, such as habeas corpus? And that's an argument in favor of using habeas corpus in order to find out what happened. Would you rather have somebody who is alleged to have driven the...
Okay, now we hear the question. David Rivkin, can we get a response?
This is a fundamental misunderstanding of how the law works in time of war. We're not talking about individuals who have necessarily committed specific ascertainable act. We're talking about individuals who have joined organizations and entities who are waging war against the United States. Doing so puts those individuals in a position to cause grave harm. The fact that they may have personally not pulled the trigger, let's say they've been caught before they even got to the front line, or as they were being trained, it is a fundamentally different proposition. They're not terrorists. They're much more than that. And by the way, the fact that you can be a lorry driver, you can be somebody who processes payroll. I mean, the critics make much of the fact that a lot of them didn't fire AK-47. That is not the point.
We're talking about the case before the Supreme Court today on detainee rights and Guantanamo Bay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Linda. And Linda's with us from Syracuse in New York.
The question I'd like the panel to address is, could they respond to how it is the very question of whether, in fact, these people are enemy combatants that needs to be answered first? And the callers seem to assume already that they are enemy combatants, and that's why they don't deserve any rights.
Gitanjali Gutierrez?
I think that's precisely the question at issue, that none of these men, and I'd have to say the people who are at Guantanamo have ranged in ages from 10 years old to well over 80, and they've never had an opportunity to go into a fair hearing, an independent hearing, and to talk about how they got picked up. There were some references earlier to the kind of hearing that you'd have in a traditional war. And those are very quick on-the-field hearings where military officers come forward. And the question before the panel is, what were the circumstances of capture? There are not many witnesses. It's a question of whether someone was carrying a weapon. Were they firing? Were they hiding things in uniform? And those are the kinds of military hearings that were referenced in today's argument. What we see at Guantanamo in the combatant status review tribunals is years after men have been detained and after hundreds of interrogations of these men or other men, of interrogations done under enhanced interrogation techniques or questionable methods, that these men then are faced with pages and pages of so-called evidence that includes secret material that they're not allowed to see, and they're somehow supposed to defend themselves in these types of hearings. And that's certainly neither the fair hearing that you'd see within the military justice system, nor is it the kind of fair hearing you would get in habeas in federal court.
And David Rivkin, let me address that issue of fairness, which goes, again, beyond the borders of this country. Guantanamo Bay, seen around the world, as a stain on American justice.
We have to be very serious about what is the relevant historical practice. With all due respect to my colleague, if you look at the history in which the laws of war have been applied, you have not had a vast majority of captured combatants get any hearings at all. If you look at Article 5, which is what the court has referred to in Rousseau, the first words is, in case of doubt. So in World War I, World War II, Civil War, Mexican-American War, 99.999% of people captured didn't get any hearings.
Well, if they were in uniform, there wasn't much doubt.
No. You could be out of uniform, and there would be no doubt. Second, these hearings, indeed, there's only one point. They typically took place earlier, but they were so austere, Neil. They're so devoid of any semblance of what we consider due process. Frequently, you didn't even have the person. There were no lawyers. There was no opportunity to present exculpatory evidence. The C-certs that you referenced earlier provide while more austere in criminal justice system, far more due process, far more fairness than in any time in human history. And that point was painfully repeated again and again by the government. Far more. How can we say with a straight face that that's not enough?
We're going to have to leave it there and get back and wait a decision in this case, which David Savage of the Los Angeles Times tells us we can expect in the middle of 2008. David, thanks as always for your time
today. Good to be with you, Neil.
And thanks also to our guest, Gitanjali Gutierrez, a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thank you very much for being with us. And
thank you, Neil.
David Rivkin, who is served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and George Bush senior administrations. They were both kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A.
Pleasure to be with you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.